Thank you for tuning in to Aster Investment Management's podcast series. A reminder to our listeners that a lot of the economic data and commentary is available on our smartphone app in the iOS and Android App Store. Just search Aster Research and download it today. This week, we are joined by our Chief Executive Officer, Rob Stein, Chief Investment Officer, John Eckstein, to discuss the current economic outlook in the era of COVID-19. Thank you all for joining us today.
Hello, and welcome to the weekly Aster Economic Week in Review. My name is John Eckstein. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of Investment Management. Joining me today, as we do every Jobs Day, is my partner and friend, Rob Stein. Rob, hello.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good, thank you. So we're recording this on October 2nd, about an hour after the jobs report, and we will get to that, obviously. A few hours before that, around 1 o'clock my time, the president and the first lady reported positive with the coronavirus. The futures market sold off about 2%. Rob, what do you think about that? I mean, obviously, we wish the president and the first lady a speedy and complete recovery.
We do.
Any other thoughts about that?
Well, it just reminds me of times when presidents or high-ranking officials got sick, were, God forbid, potentially assassinated, and it wreaks havoc on the market. And that's what happened. It would be surprising to see if this was the beginning of a trend caused by this, but I think it's a statement on what is happening with COVID, what's happening with our response to it, and what's happening with the president's rhetoric. Now, I'm not taking a side here or there, but I think the economy and the markets are starting to react now more to political and maybe even presidential experiences. You know, John, we talked about the last 4, 5, 6 weeks expected increases in volatility due to the uncertainty of the election. And I don't think we've seen what we were expecting.
Yeah, so we can date ourselves a little bit and talk about an assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. Most important futures market at that time, the 30-year treasury was limit up, meaning that people were scared about the reaction, and then limit down a few hours later. And it's never had a day like that since. Even in the global financial crisis or in March of this year, it's unmatched in terms of treasury market volatility.
They still talk about that.
I still talk about it.
Right. There was a similar day in the crash with euro dollars, which were new. But you're right, the uncertainty and market liquidity, people running for the door. Technology, yes. And electronic trading changed that a little bit, I think.
Yeah, so let me get explicit about bringing the listeners in a little bit on what we're talking about when we talk about some of the volatility stuff you were just mentioning, because that can be a little bit of inside baseball. But one thing we're looking at is the VIX, right? The so-called fear gauge, and that is a measure that's derived from S&P options prices. And so how much volatility are options traders expecting roughly in a month from now? Now that is starting to get into the window of the election. There's also futures on the VIX, which give you, in some sense, a prediction of where traders think volatility is going to be. And there's definitely a big hump in the shape of that curve, meaning that the futures market expects volatility to increase between now and a month from now, and then increase further the month after that. Not to levels that we saw in March, but at levels that are, high, like 75th percentile or so. So today's VIX is 28, well above the average of the last couple of years of, say 18. 2 months from now, the VIX future is pricing in a VIX of 33, 5 VIX points higher from there. That's kind of what you were talking about, right, Rob?
Yes. While compared to the average we've had, I don't want to isolate the average of the month coming into the elections. I certainly recall the last cycle, volatility from every single sentence about who was winning, who wasn't, would drive the markets a couple percentage points. And we're just not seeing that now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the polling has been extremely stable. Like, I think all the Democrats in the world have sort of PTSD from polling last time. So we're not going to say it too far. We don't upset our audience. But the polling has been extremely stable for a long time. Both Trump's approval and disapproval ratings have moved in a much, much narrower range than any other president, since modern polling began. And the polling for the presidency has been in a very narrow range. Of course, the first thing that people are thinking about when the market is thinking about when the news about the president came through was that, is this going to change the election, right? So the market has like the likeliest expectation baked in, and is this going to change the election percentages? We'll see, but nothing else has changed the election, right? Like the debate didn't change the election, the convention didn't change the elections, the scandals didn't change the elections. So my expectation is that, you know, we're going to be a week from now and the polling averages are going to be just what they are. And then the election's coming right up, right? Like if Trump's going to make up ground, he's got to do it right now. He's got a lot of ground to make up. He needs to get going.
Right. No, great point. The lack of volatility in people's opinions is probably correlated with the market movements. But you know, as we switch over to economics and the portfolio, and you'll give us a rundown of the data of the week, I think the main story there is how the data continues. I expected, at least, John, that we would have more volatility in the data. I guess I'm the volatility guy this week. I expected more volatility in the markets. I expected more volatility in VIX.
Be careful what you wish for, Rob. Be careful what you wish for.
And in the end of the day, more volatility is probably better for us. But, you know, when you're looking at the numbers and they came from a place where they were ridiculously moving from extreme to extreme, and now they're within the range of expectations, which it's clearly higher than the ranges have been, and even our own models of what it would take to materially move those, I thought it would take a little bit longer than the few months for the data to kind of get into needs to do this in order to do that.
That's a good idea. Let's bring the conversation around to today's numbers. Again, it's payroll Friday. The numbers came out an hour or two ago, so we might revise our interpretation. So the big picture of the number is non-farm payrolls came out at plus 661,000 when people were expecting more like 860,000. That is a miss. But on the other hand, the last 2 months were revised positive 145,000. So that actually gets you pretty close to what expectations were in the number of new jobs. The unemployment rate dropped from 8.4 to 7.9. That sounds like good news, but a lot of that drop is due to people dropping out of the labor force. Labor force participation rate went from 61.7 to 61.4 when we were hoping it would be increasing, that people would be going back into the labor force. To my mind, the fundamental fact of the labor market is that, you know, compared to the amount of jobs that we lost over March and April, we've made about half of those jobs back. And the pace of the increase is declining. So that's my big picture.
Right. No, John, and you talked about that. I think you even used the word plateau. And I agree with that. And I think you could see anecdotal evidence of that as the streets get a little bit more crowded. But, you know, I was in the Loop downtown Chicago yesterday. It was a little bit busier, but not much busier than it was a week or so ago. You have the seasons changing. But I think you have a different mentality of the workforce. And I don't know if we're going to see the workforce expand. So it wasn't a surprise to me. I think you are seeing systemic shifts in the workforce itself, people who might count themselves working differently that aren't just trying to work from home from some big giant company. And I think that'll impact these labor numbers, but it'll be interesting to see GDP output. We had ISM earlier this week. You know, you'll talk about it, but still above 50. Giant savings rate. You know, there's definitely a bifurcated economy. And my bigger fear isn't the participation rate. It's when we get the white collar, whatever you want to call that next segment of the workforce, getting nervous about their job. I think that'll be the real interesting thing. It's the breakdown of the employment report, now not just the actual number divided by the amount of people in the workforce.
I think that's a good point. These are job losses that are still concentrated in the most economically vulnerable parts of the country. So people with less education, non-white people, are having a tougher time. While before we get off the job market, I also want to say that the number of permanent job losers continues to increase. It is not back up to where it was in the Great Recession, but it's about halfway there. And that number's gone up about every month. So, you know, when people are report themselves as unemployed, they can say, I expect to go back to work, temporary furlough, or I'm permanently unemployed. And the permanently unemployed number has been going up every month, and we need to turn that around.
And I'm curious as to see how we're going to be counting college students who are working from home, a higher percentage of them looking for some form of job while...
Oh, it'd be interesting, college. Right? Because like a lot of times if you were to go to college, like you have a little work study job.
Yeah.
One other little piece of data on the payroll is that private employment actually did much better than unemployment as a whole. So what does that mean? The balance is state and local workers, notably not census workers, but state and local workers, there were about a loss of about 250,000. And so what you're thinking is that there's a big season, you're expecting to have a seasonal hike in jobs as schools open, you know, as you rehire janitors or what have you. And you, and I think you did not get that hike this year, sort of my interpretation of that.
You know, John, coming out of the Great Recession, we saw a little bit of a lag in government jobs and even to a certain extent government spending. And I think you have to look at that as something that's going to happen eventually. Government jobs or non-private sector jobs, they're going to happen at some point.
But they're going to happen. They're going to come back at some point, or they're not going to come back at some point?
No, they are. They are.
Yeah, but you're right. That was a huge drag in the last recovery. For the first several years, the last recovery, it was a huge drag in the economy. And those jobs have multiplier effects just like every other job.
Right. What's ironic, and not being political, but there was the last administration was called out as bigger government, not smaller. And we had lower growth in jobs and for a brief time spending. Not political, but I think the pattern, regardless of which administration is in the office, government job growth will get back to trend probably before anything else is my opinion. And you're right about the magnifier effect.
Yeah, I guess I'm worried that it's not going to get back to trend for a long time because, you know, state and local governments are going to have to cut their spending a lot. Also on the jobs market, but a different report, the claims number came out this week is basically unchanged. So unchanged is not getting worse, but it's also not getting better. And it's still extremely high numbers. Both the pandemic unemployment insurance, the gig worker, and the standard claims numbers are both together, but they're not changing very much. Similarly to the permanent job losses issue is that there's programs for people whose regular unemployment insurance expires, and those are going up every month as well. There's about 2 million people on those jobs for people who have been on the regular state claims for 26 weeks and still don't have a job.
Yeah, there is expectation and a little bit of market volatility on the next potential stimulus package.
Oh, yeah.
And it is interesting how the market moves as we report getting closer or farther about that. And that kind of circles back to a bit of a philosophy that a lot of the market is being driven more so than we probably identify by liquidity stimulus relief packages. And they're finding its way into the markets or risk assets, certainly.
What's your expectation for a fiscal package? And what do you think the market's expectation is?
So I think the market's expectation, taking your last question first, is high. I think almost
trillion?
Counting on it.
It's and high expectation
close to matching the last round, you know, whether it's, you know, $1,200 in the mail or other relief programs. Evictions and foreclosures are going to be at the forefront very soon. I think if there's an administration shift, probably have the high end of the range and all the consequences that come with that.
But that wouldn't even be put in the law until January if we're waiting for a new administration.
Yeah, good point. But you know as well as I do that the anticipation of something that looks like it's certain
that's
probably
true.
Has a bigger impact on the market than when it happens. What's the adage of buy the rumor, sell the fact?
Buy the rumor, sell the fact is one rules that works on Wall Street.
And so I think you're getting a little bit of that. And as the rumor gets perhaps bigger, you know, the Johnny story or more certain, I am expecting to see the market respond in kind.
Yeah.
So I think that the liquidity and the expectation of additional liquidity is a big driver of this market. And when we finish going through the economic data, I'll kind of share what I'm thinking is one of the tailwinds or one of the reasons that we're having such almost parabolic growth in the averages.
Oh, okay. So that's what we call a teaser. So make people stick around for the rest of the episode. I like it. I like your broadcasting style. Let's talk about the purchasing managers' numbers next. So the ISM manufacturing number came out a little bit below expectations, but still at 55. So that's a number, roughly 55% of respondents said things were getting better of manufacturing. The sub-indices, the new orders were down a lot, but still at 60, and employment edged up, but is still below 50. So employment is not increasing, but is decreasing at a slower rate. Any comments on the manufacturing sector?
The fact that it's above 50, whether you're getting it growing at a slower pace or even declining, as we know, it's a diffusion index over 50, shows growth. I think it's tough to compare whether we're, you know, one number to the next. It's probably more prudent to compare above expansion or contraction levels.
Yeah.
And you still have a really high savings rate, housing, retail sales.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the spending and compensation numbers. So if you look at the income from wages and employment benefits together, that's still above where we were in February. So compensation, wages, and salaries is down from where we were in February. Unemployment insurance is slightly more than making that up. And though in August, which is the last number we have, unemployment insurance paid out about 40% of what it paid out in May, June, and July. So overall, one thing the government's done very well has been helping out people who actually lost their jobs. So now the spending numbers are moderating a little bit, though still above average. But I wanted to mention the savings rate. Basically, if you just take the sum, the amount people have saved every month for like the last 12 months, you see that is about, you know, more than $1 trillion more than normal.
Record levels.
Right. So not only record levels, but like $20 trillion economy, there is like $1.2 trillion sitting in people's checking accounts. I think that's a mixture of rich people who can't spend on what they used to, but also people who are doing precautionary savings. But I guess like, that's the most optimistic thing about the economy right now to me, is that there's all this dry powder. As that gets lured in, either gradually or all at once, people could be surprised by how quickly that could take off once we can find a catalyst for it.
Well, right. And that is a bright spot. And we'll have to see whether the savings rate for the percentage of the population that won't need to save it. A lot of the problem after the great financial crisis was getting money out of the system. In fact, believe it or not, there was very weak loan demand. But it's also important to note that that money doesn't just sit under the mattress. It is in the banking system. The banks do things with them, whatever it is that they do. I think it leaks itself into the economy already. Perhaps some of these numbers are a byproduct of that. So we'll see. It's a very, very large number. John, wouldn't you agree that when you get savings rates that high, you would see other sides of the economy that would have numbers that connected to that in some way, shape, or form? Perhaps ISM or GDP numbers, personal consumption, those types of things would counterbalance in the short run?
You should.
Savings rate high, you're buying one less widget.
Yeah, that definitely flows through to the economy, right? But so because the savings rate is high, people aren't spending it by definition, right? So sitting in checking accounts, or maybe they're investing it a little bit, maybe they're putting their Robinhood accounts, so it'll flow through to there. And so, but then the question is, so the money that's sitting at the bank, so as you pointed out, during the last recovery, people didn't want to borrow and banks were reluctant to lend, which isn't really fuel for the fire. And I think we're in a similar space right now, in that banks are definitely reluctant to lend. You definitely see loan officer surveys being much more conservative than they were before COVID came down. So if banks not lending and they're just, you know, buying treasuries with your deposit, then sort of the velocity of money idea is going to, you know, if you think about that idea, how much is money going to circulation? Not at all in that scenario that I just laid out.
Right, but I think you're not seeing that. With lending weak, the velocity of money consumption logically should be weaker, GDP, ISM. I don't think we're seeing the correlation as direct as I would expect between a generally high savings rate and what that does to overall economic activity, or at least
the high rate. I don't know. Like, I think that if you have a high savings rate, that means that, you know, people aren't spending the money, and so you'd have lower levels of economic growth. And I think that's pretty consistent with where we are now, right? Like sort of a tepid growth level.
But aren't you surprised at some of the numbers that aren't tepid? Retail sales, I think, somewhat robust almost. Housing, I mean, you're...
Well, housing is definitely an exception, right? Housing is an exception. But, you know, the consumption numbers are lower than they would be. Like they went up a lot. They went down a lot. They didn't go up as much, and they're lower than they would be otherwise.
No, but we're talking about record savings and lower than otherwise consumption numbers. I think it's a little imbalanced, at least right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Consumption, personal outlays in February, or let's say in January, was about at a $15 trillion pace, got down to 13, and now it's back up to 14. If you extend the trend out, it should be, you know, send the up closer to 16. So we're at a pace that's still well below the trend line we were on before. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm hopeful that if we find a little bit of a footing, if we get a vaccine, if things feel a little better for people, all that savings, you know, is sort of dry tinder.
I think we agree on that, right? That savings is dry tinder. How and when it gets into the economy, we'll see the effect. We kind of agreed that it was slower and less significant during the last financial crisis the last time savings rate went up to this high. And it'll show up in the numbers. And we'll do this call and we'll
oh my gosh, I can't believe how much everyone's spending.
Exactly.
And then everyone's going to be worried about, everyone on TV is going to be worried about people are spending too much. That's definitely going to happen. I've got one more number that I want to talk about before we go back to what you wanted to close the podcast with, and that is the consumer sentiment numbers. Consumer sentiment has been increasing steadily for the past 4 or 5 weeks. There's a bunch of different indicators that come out. They've all come out fairly strong. Again, if you think about like sort of before COVID and after COVID, we've made it halfway back to where we were before COVID roughly. But like the most recent period, the last month or month and a half, has been quite strong.
I think a little bit of that can, we talked about the volatility in the stock market to the extent people are traveling, they are seeing some lower prices. And I think everybody is feeling a little better about the lifestyle that they have embraced. Yes, there's concern, pandemic could go on forever, more people dying, it's on the news all day. But I think people's overall concern has dissipated a little bit, at least in the circle I travel in. And that could impact the responses to consumer sentiment and the stock market, high correlation between stock market and consumer sentiment.
Yeah, the one thing that's interesting about that, if you break out sentiment numbers for Republicans and Democrats, you'll see that Republican sentiment went up in November 2016 and Democratic sentiment went down in 2016. They both stayed there. And if Biden wins, that's going to reverse. So you're like, oh gosh, that's sort of an even switch. You might not mind, but the Republicans are really this party of small business in the stock market, then that could have an effect on the stock market as well, right?
Agreed. That happened last time too.
Yep. Is there any other economic numbers you want to talk about before we...
No, I think we covered it. Certainly in the scope of how we feel these numbers, the story they truly tell.
Okay, Rob, before we sign off, was there one more thing you wanted to bring up?
Yes. I don't want to veer too far off away of looking at the economic numbers and getting over ahead of our skis, but I am concerned about inflation. I have a blog post coming up about my view on inflation and why the inflation coming, I think, will have even bigger and maybe some unintended consequences that we haven't seen in typical spikes in inflation in the past. The Fed has talked about getting it to 2%. We haven't done that. Now, all of a sudden, they're going to be looking at an average. I think that could be a two-edged sword, telling your kid to come home at 9 and they're constantly coming home at 9:30. And then they start pushing it to 10 and you're not really recognizing it. And one of the definitions of inflation, too much money chasing too few goods. We're actually having that. We're bypassing the technical financial system of how the money supply grew. I think that that's going to seep in. And I want to be clear, not tomorrow, not next quarter, probably not next quarter after that, maybe not even the following year. But $3 trillion of debt's going to be floated, clearly shortages, high savings rates on top of it. I start to see a scenario where we can have, dare I say, hyperinflation, and then the implications for what you do in that environment. And it's tough to be mindful of something that hasn't been around for a while. It isn't starting to show its impact directly into the consumers. So I don't want to get too into the nitty-gritty. Hopefully, John, we can talk about it periodically.
We should have a special inflation show. So this is, you've been worried about this for a while. You're obviously not the only one. I guess I would say, I think we're going to have to watch it carefully, obviously. One thing I would say about the Fed is that their new framework was, you know, written by committee and given them a lot of wiggle room. They don't have a rule. They don't even say what sort of average they're looking at. If they're looking at an average, you've had governors come out, push back against one interpretation, and other governors say there's another interpretation. And so basically, I see their new framework as an extremely subtle shift. They've given themselves permission to not raise rates the moment inflation goes above 2%. But if they want to raise rates when it goes above 2% because they think it's going to be high in the intermediate term, they can do that too. So I'm not sure how that is going to operationalize. And so the other thing is, like, right now, certainly, I don't think that there's too much money chasing too few goods. There's 12 million people without jobs. There's 12 million gig workers who are underemployed. So we have like a ton of real resources that are sitting around not being used. And factory capacity is only 70% of what it could be. So for now, that's not a problem. Though, you know, what we were just saying about the savings rate being a big pile of dry tinder, like in California, that speaks to your point, right? If that money were to come into the economy all at once, and that could be a scenario that you're talking about, right? Like, you know, we're tooling along at whatever level, then all of a sudden everybody gains their confidence back, and that $1.5 trillion comes to the car market or whatever, you know, in a week and a half.
Right. No, those are all good points. And, you know, capacity utilization rate and the unemployed coming in to soak that up. But we're coming through a period of what we had just-in-time inventory. They were able to measure how much was needed and make the appropriate amount. Inventories wouldn't have that boom-bust cycle that we're used to.
Well, we were used to it, right? But we're well above the median now, Rob.
It is.
We have this thing called a business cycle, kids. Google it.
Right, exactly. And it's not just one rainy day calling it a spring or one snow day calling it winter, correct? But I think that the thing about the boom bust cycle is the reaction that would happen for small changes in either consumption or inventory. We did some experiments in college that really showed how the inventory cycle expectations of demand would shift with just one more beer bought. So I think we're going to have some of that. That will.
Beer is not an experiment, Rob. I just want to say that. Okay.
Offline, I'll tell you about it because it was quite clever and it was done in a way that engaged a lot of students in the 80s, I'll tell you. We were all beer manufacturers in this fictitious brewery and they controlled how much beer we could drink and or produce. So I think that unlike a scenario where lumber is at 60% capacity, lumber prices are going up, construction and people fixing your house are having to charge higher prices, and then that trickling through is real and will not get back to levels that, okay, 40% of the people who are out of work are back in, the lumber trucks are running, supplies meeting demand, and away we go. Prices are very inelastic on the downside. And to the extent that you are getting some price increases, just because you get additional supply and workers back, I'm not so sure that the free market will drive those prices back to where we were. And keep in mind, right now, we're talking about inflation as it relates to prices and not the monetary phenomena that is clearly going to occur based on what's happening with the money supply. So you can look at it from many different angles: supply, demand, cost push, demand pull, increases in overnight lending, the repo market, the bank's purchases of whatever it is they're purchasing this week. And I think that we're having kind of a perfect storm with whatever type of inflation you've studied. It's a higher probability of occurring than in the past. You combine that with 3-4 different types of inflation, and I get concerned, or I see it around the corner. That's my take on inflation. And you know, certainly asset price bubbles, stock market, can't just be telling the story of growth.
Yeah. I think we'll have to leave it there. Do you think that we have to schedule an inflation special, a very special episode of the Astro Economic Week in Review? So next week, we'll have services PMI. We'll have the JOLTS job opening numbers, some consumer credit, and the regular jobless claims. So it's going to be a busy next week as well. I would like to thank Sibylla for producing. And thank you all for listening, and leave a rating if you can. A lot of the charts we talk about can be accessed at Aster app, which you can get from the Google or Android app store. You can look for Aster Research. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you. Thank you, John. I'll see you in a few minutes on IC.
To learn more about Aster Investment Management's research and strategies, please visit us on the web at www.asterim.com or stay up to date by following us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and our app is also available on the App Store and Google Play. Thank you. Aster Investment Management, LLC, is a SEC-registered investment advisor. All information contained herein is for informational purposes only. This is not a solicitation to offer investment advice or services in any state where to do so would be unlawful. Analysis and research are provided for informational purposes only, not for trading or investing purposes. All opinions expressed are as of the date of publication and subject to change. They are not intended as investment recommendations.